BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Dame Helena Morrissey, one of the City of London's leading lights. She's globally renowned as a leader and changemaker. As a CEO, she oversaw a £30 billion increase at her investment management company while building a reputation as someone who worked differently. One of her first decisions was to offer everyone working there a 4-day week. Later, she founded the 30% Club, which recently achieved its titular target, boosting the representation of women on UK boards. Alongside her career and campaigning, her aptitude for figures comes in handy at home. She recently calculated that her family had gone through at least 148 birthday cakes since the eldest of her 9 children was born. She says, "If anyone had said to me when I was a shy and gawky teenager that one day I would have 9 children and be the chief executive of an investment company and work on initiatives to drive gender equality, I would have laughed nervously." Dame Helena Morrissey, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Lauren. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So you've written that leaders today need to earn the right to lead, to inspire, not to force. You're regarded as one of the world's top leaders. What is the key to inspiring people?
Well, I think starting with listening and understanding what's important to them and understanding that lots of us have aspirations. We want to achieve whatever we can in life. But I think, you know, inspiring people to... sounds cheesy, be the best version of themselves, requires, first of all, understanding what that is. And I love the fact that nowadays leadership is not just about telling people what to do. It's not just about commanding and controlling, but it is really understanding what will make them the best version.
I mean, that's even more difficult in extreme circumstances, isn't it? And at the moment, there are challenges for leaders all across the board in every line of work. The coronavirus crisis at the moment, you know, we're speaking on the 11th of March. There's the Brexit negotiations, the impact of climate change on our communities. What qualities do you think leaders need now?
Well, I think they need empathy, and I think they need to understand that if everybody's anxious, then they're going to need reassurance, even if sometimes that means being honest and saying, actually, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know exactly what will happen. But actually, we can all take one step in front of the other. We can get there. And I think sometimes just reassuring people by being there, by being available for talking to them, and not just assuming that because you put out some massive email to everybody in the company that they understand that everything is being looked after. People need the human touch.
I know that the tag superwoman is often applied to you. Do you think superwomen are made or born?
I realise as I look back, and you don't necessarily choose to be the way you are, but I recognise that I've always been quite driven, just sort of wanted to achieve things. I mean, I was this manic brownie when I was, you know, 7, 8, 9, and I wanted to break the record for the most badges. I mean, now I sort of half laugh, half cry at that thought. But at the time, I really enjoyed doing that. But I think people can do a lot more than they imagine they can do sometimes. We can stretch more. And sometimes just, again, in my own life, I haven't sort of had 9 children all in one go. You know, I've had single pregnancies, and everything in my career has been, I suppose, almost like living every day in a certain way. And then it gradually builds. And I try to encourage more people to do that.
It's time to dive into your music, Helena. What's the first disc you've chosen for us?
I've chosen George Harrison's My Sweet Lord. This is a song that I love. And for me, when it's played, I just immediately picture my entire family at my eldest daughter Florence's wedding to Benjamin Clementine. My eldest son was playing the guitar, and all of the other children besides Flo were singing. Fitz wasn't with us, and we had him recorded on his guitar playing. And, you know, they really put a lot of work in just to make it special. And at the end, my youngest picked up the tambourine and skipped down the aisle, and the happy couple followed her.
My sweet Lord, my Lord, my Lord, I really want to see you. Really want to see you, Lord, but it takes so long.
George Harrison and My Sweet Lord, taking you back to a very special family moment, Helena Morrissey. You and I are talking today on the morning when the Bank of England cut interest rates to help mitigate the possible impact of the coronavirus on business. You were in the running to become the first female governor to succeed Mark Carney. How do you feel about not getting that position?
I obviously feel slightly disappointed, but on the other hand, I certainly did not presume that I was going to get it. I entered the race partly because I encourage other women to go for things. And I felt that perhaps at this juncture, because I'm not a central banker, I've worked in the city for a long time, but I felt that maybe someone with a bit more lateral thinking, some different perspectives was needed. And so it's no good me saying that theoretically if I'm that possible person. And actually, I think it was good that I was interviewed in the sense that my application was taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people bring different qualities to it. And they obviously decide to go in a certain way. They've chosen someone who's very much steeped in regulatory background.
So you received your damehood for services to diversity in financial services. And for you, diversity, I think it's important to say, isn't just diversity among people, but includes diversity of opinion. Why is that important?
Well, obviously, I care a lot about equal opportunities, but I also want businesses to be well run. I want them to serve their customers and clients well. And I'd love to see the British economy do brilliantly. And all of that's only going to happen if we have the most creative, most inspired ideas and people around the table. And I think the financial crisis of a decade ago showed us that actually, if you just have one type of person around the table, often not just because they were all men, or all white, or all a certain age, but often very similarly educated, hang out with each other in the same social circles, then it's really difficult to get that creative spark and to have the challenge. And I really see the point of diversity as being, yes, about equal opportunity, but also, just as importantly, about having better thinking, better companies, and a better economy for everybody's benefit.
It's time to go to the music. It's your second disc today, Helena. Why have you chosen it?
This is Chopin's Heroic Polonaise in A flat major. As a child, I learnt the piano and I did this very seriously for a while. And at one stage, my parents were thinking of, you know, sending me to music school. I'm rather glad they didn't because I'm very happy with my life, but I worked very hard at the piano. And this was effectively the hardest piece that I ever learnt. I can't play it nowadays. It's very frustrating if you were once half proficient to not play something quite so well. But every time I hear it, I think of that time in my life. My dad spent so long listening to me practice. I mean, he was a saint with hindsight, and I hope I didn't take it for granted. But it reminds me of those happy times when, well, happy for me, when I was playing and he would listen.
Of Chopin's Heroic Polonaise in A-flat, played by Arthur Rubinstein, and in earlier years by you, Dame Helena Morrissey.
Yes, not quite the same way as he plays it.
Anyways, it must have been pretty good.
Well, for a while I was, and as I say, I practice several hours a day, but you need to keep that up, and I'm afraid I don't these days.
So tell me a little bit more about yourself at a young age. You described yourself earlier as a manic brownie. Which is a very
and
strong visual image.
All sorts of strange skills, like metalworking. Well, not that strange, but for me, in my current life, it is. And semaphore. And, you know, I remember my dad standing at the end. We had a long, thin garden. And so the semaphore flags were used and I had to translate it and then do it back to him. So he had to learn it too. But up until this point, I haven't had any need for it. But I enjoyed learning the technique at the time.
So you were very driven, very competitive about collecting these badges and these skills. What did it feel like? What were you after? Was it the skill that you wanted to learn or was it the accolade that you were chasing?
Yeah, I didn't know that there would be an accolade, actually. I think the local newspaper pictured me with all my badges on my arm, but I didn't anticipate that. But I think somebody had got 31 badges. And so I just thought the logical thing was to try to get 32. And I don't know why, really. It's a mystery to me to this day.
Well, as you say, we've
it just is.
We've had less well-prepared castaways off to this desert island, so it will come in handy.
This could be my opportunity for finally using all of those strange skills that I've picked up.
But interesting to see, you know, your drive kicking in so early. Your mother and father, Jackie and Tony, were teachers and very supportive by the sounds of it.
Yes, and I mentioned my dad listening to me practicing the piano. My mother, you know, avid reader, always loved poetry and novels and always would discuss, you know, the topics of the day with me. And stalwart members of our village church. They gave me a lot of freedom. We moved when I was about 10 to a more countryside village, and my sister and I came down with mumps the day we moved. So we were quarantined basically for the summer holidays, and we just went off on our bicycles. I was 10, she was 6. Obviously, way before the days of mobile phones, we took a picnic, and my mum would say, come back at 6 for supper.
Apparently, you also showed early leadership in your play as a child because you ran a school.
Yes, sorry, Liz, my sister, my little sister. She was my only pupil. And, you know, I was very solemn about the whole thing. And actually, I turned those bicycle rides into part of the school. You know, we'd go on a nature trail hunt and so forth. But with hindsight, I was a bit strict.
It's time to hear your third disc today. What's it going to be?
So it's The Carpenters, We've Only Just Begun. And this resonates with me on so many levels. My parents always played lots of music. And one day my mum bought The Carpenters. It was the singles, I think 1969 to 73, and the opening track on that is We've Only Just Begun. And when I first heard it, I just could not believe how beautiful Karen Carpenter's voice was. And very sadly, of course, she died at the age of 32 of anorexia or complications around that. And I actually suffered from that in my teenage years. I think she died about a year, 2 years after I had recovered. So that, unfortunately, it's a poignant connection. It's so tragic that she lost her life. And it just makes me feel both happy and sad to listen to this.
We've only just begun to live. White lace and promises. A kiss for luck and we're on our way.
The Carpenters and We've Only Just Begun. Helena Morrissey, a poignant track for you. As you said, you suffered from anorexia in your teens and you suffered for about a year and then recovered quite quickly.
It was very scary for my parents, and I wasn't much shorter than I am now. So I was about 5'5" or 6" and I only weighed 5 stone. And so now I look back and the pictures are utterly hideous. But of course, in my mind, I had this very warped image. I thought I was fat, and you know, I can remember getting on the scales and thinking, oh, I'm going to get down to 4 stone, you know, whatever it was. And it's obviously completely irrational and very worrying for parents. And as I mentioned, my parents gave me a very stable background. I think this was probably me being a bit worried about growing up, being scared of growing up, I think.
You've felt it was rooted in that anxiety.
Yeah, I think anorexia is now known to be a lot to do with wanting to have control over an aspect of your life. And, you know we don't have control over lots of our life. And controlling what you consume and completely controlling that, you can do that, but obviously it's not a healthy thing. And I actually do recall that sense of recognizing suddenly the self-destruction part of it, and that it was something I couldn't do. I couldn't run or something. And I suddenly, the scales fell from my eyes and it sort of switched off, and I wanted to get better and I wanted to, be part of the world and to grow up and, you know, do what I could. But it was, it did last for a little while. And, it did get quite serious.
By sixth form, as a teenager, you were the only girl doing maths and further maths at your comprehensive secondary school. How did your fellow students react to you?
Well, I put it that I was teased, but I probably would be described as being bullied these days. My problem was I wasn't that great at maths, which people might say, why did I study double maths? But I've already intimated I like a challenge. Anyway, what transpired after that was I could have either given up or I could have worked out a way through it. And I tried the latter, and there were 12 subjects on the syllabus and 6 were supposedly easy. And then 6 were regarded as very difficult. So I realised that If I learnt the hard six, I could predict the questions. So very slowly, over six terms, I mastered six topics. And I noticed that the dynamic changed a bit. The boys would compete with each other a lot, but because I then caught them up, like very much the tortoise in the tortoise and the hare race, they suddenly looked at me differently. And they would also ask me when they got stuck, or I would ask them, and everybody started sharing. So I like to think, you know, that was the first example of a bit of diversity in the classroom. And I feel that it was an important lesson for me that actually things aren't usually impossible, but you do have to be calm about it and work out a strategy.
Let's go to the music. It's your fourth disc. Why have you chosen it?
So this one is a dance track, Pet Shop Boys Being Boring. And in my younger years, I certainly loved dancing. It reminds me of my time at Cambridge University. I was lucky enough to go there and I met Richard, my husband, and we both liked Pet Shop Boys. This track was actually released after we'd left, but to me, the words in particular summarise so much about young people. And also there's a line in it where it talks about listening to people who open closed doors, and I try to do that.
When you're young, you find inspiration in anyone who's ever gone and opened up a closing door. She said we were never feeling bored, 'cause we were never being boring. We had too much time to find.
Pet Shop Boys and Being Boring, taking you back to your days at Cambridge, Dame Helena Morrissey. So at 18, there you were, reading philosophy rather than mathematics, and you describe university life as liberating. In what way?
Well, I'd had quite a sheltered upbringing, and suddenly there were these people who were much more worldly than me, and I was exposed to, obviously, Cambridge has amazing debates. And it just was eye-opening to me.
On graduating, you joined Schroders Asset Management Company in 1987. What was the appeal of a career in wealth management?
Well, I honestly didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. And friends of mine were applying to the city and they encouraged me. I mean, mostly men, they were encouraging me. And they said, look, you like writing, you like talking, you like numbers, you would enjoy it. So it was a bit of a leap into the unknown. And I really loved the people that I met at Schroders. In fact, in my first interview, it was a man and a woman. At the time, I thought that was completely normal. And now I realise that the woman was very unusual to be working in a senior role in the city. And I came across her the other day, actually, and I said, oh, you're the reason why I joined the city. You know, she was so inspiring to me. And then they sent me off to New York for 2 years.
So you were an apprentice in their New York office. The company culture is something that's very important to you today. Tell me about what life was like there then.
So this was the time of Wall Street, the first movie. Greed is good. Everybody, including myself, wore pinstripe trouser suits. I mean, I'm saying that embarrassed now that I went out and bought a trouser suit that had chalky stripes on it. And the women in the office, I mean, there were quite a few and they really called the shots. They were highly regarded. When I came back to London, I was a bit taken aback because I was the only woman in a team of 16.
And the corporate culture presumably very different too.
I mean, it seems funny now, but we had a morning meeting in London that started at 11:45 a.m. People would sort of roll in and it was all very clubby and, you know, hierarchical. New York, everyone worked every hour that they had. So, yes, culturally, it was quite different and there were very, very few women. So it was quite difficult, I'll be honest.
So you came back to London, you and Richard married and you had your first child, Fitz, in 1991. And then once you were back at work, you didn't receive the promotion that you'd expected to. What happened?
I was eligible for this first promotion and I didn't get it. And my two male colleagues who joined the same time as me, they did. And I asked my boss, what did I need to do differently? And he said, oh, there's nothing wrong with your performance, but, you know, there is a bit of doubt over your commitment with a baby. Now, I had just literally walked back in the door. I hadn't been away for all that long, 5 months. So I wasn't expecting that at all. I was quite bewildered because maybe naively, I thought that my gender would have absolutely nothing to do with how far I could progress. That really was the first taste of the inequality as it was in the city at the time and probably gave me a bit of fire in my belly about, you know, trying to do something about that.
Time for some more music. Let's have your fifth disc, if you wouldn't mind.
So my fifth disc is Moon River, and I've chosen the Audrey Hepburn version as she sung this in the movie Breakfast at Tiffany. And she's always been an icon for me and hugely inspirational, not just because she's so elegant, but did a huge amount of humanitarian work in her later years and just seemed to be a very giving person. And this makes me think of her movies and what a wonderful person she seems to have been.
Style someday, old dream maker, you heart breaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way.
Audrey Hepburn performing Moon River. Dame Helena Morrissey, you joined Newton Investment Management as a fixed income fund manager in 1994. In 2001, you were offered the role of chief investment officer, but you were quickly made aware that your colleagues didn't support you. They didn't believe you had the requisite experience in the field, but they did see you as a leader. They wanted you to become CEO instead. How did you react at the time to that news?
Well, I said yes, but then I called my husband and said, well, I'm not going to be the CIO, as it's dubbed, but the CEO instead. And he said to me, well, what does that job entail? And I honestly answered, well, I'm not quite sure. But I did know that I really wanted to lead my colleagues who'd just been taken over by an American firm, which is why there had been some vacancies. And I said yes when a lot of people would have said no. And it wasn't that easy. I didn't have any training. I'd never run a business, and I also had five children. The youngest had just turned 1, 2, and 3. So this was a full-on time in my life, and there's no two ways about that. And probably a sensible person would have said no, but I don't regret it.
How quickly did you become aware of the scale of the challenge you were facing?
Well, almost immediately, actually. It was a real baptism of fire, and I made loads of mistakes. I'll be the first to admit that, including on, I think, day two, taking a call from a tabloid newspaper who had heard about my appointment and asked me lots of questions, and I freely gave lots of information. And then, of course, the next day, my colleagues were hardly speaking to me, and I hadn't even seen the newspaper, and it did rather diminish me. But you can learn from mistakes, and if we are afraid of making those mistakes, we'll never try anything.
And one of your favourite sayings is leap before you look. Why is that?
Yeah, because again, I think we're told so often the other way around, you know, look and then make your mind up. Let's do a bit more leaping and less looking, and then be ourselves along the way. Be authentic. I went from being, you know, a team member and doing okay in my career to being invited to become the chief executive, you know, because I had learnt my own style of delivery, my own style of dress. You know, I had grown into that style. I had stopped sort of looking over at what everybody else was doing, and I'd branched out a bit.
In her book Lean In, Sheryl Sandberg, CEO of Facebook, says that women hold themselves back by their fear of not being liked, and that our own discomfort with women as leaders can be a hindrance as well. To what extent has that been your experience in your career?
So I think we often do hold ourselves back for all sorts of reasons. And I'd be quite open about the fact that I know I like to be liked. I don't like aggressive confrontation at all. And I think that's been something that certainly I've had to work on and recognise that sometimes you have to make unpopular decisions as a leader. I think that we also need to try to change the nature of what it means to be powerful and to be an effective leader. And actually, I think this is where, I mean, I applaud what Sheryl Sandberg's done on so many levels in terms of using her power to create a conversation about all of this. But I do feel that leaning into the status quo is not the answer, that actually we should be contributing as women, feminine characteristics, particularly empathy, particularly listening, particularly collaboration and building consensus, and not having that sort of rather stereotypical macho, I'm telling you what to do approach to leadership.
And how would you like to see workplace cultures change, you know, to adapt to include women more easily?
Well, I think the listening part is very important. For example, if you're chairing a meeting, it's not a question of just repeating things that we knew going into the meeting, listening to the guy or woman who's shouting loudest, but actually skillfully drawing out the opinions of perhaps the introverted person of making sure that you start the meeting by saying, look, this is what we already know. Let's not just repeat that. I mean, so many meetings are a complete waste of time. They're just showcases for people who are already powerful in a company. Whereas actually, I'm interested in getting the right strategy, the right answers, and then people feeling very involved and wanting to execute them, make them happen.
It's time to take a break for some music. Your sixth disc today. What are we going to hear?
So now we're coming right up to the present, and I've chosen the Clementines' first single, Calm Down. Now, the Clementines are my eldest daughter, Florence, and her husband, Benjamin, and both of them have recorded in the past as solo artists. This was released before, just as the coronavirus was starting to cause more widespread anxiety. So the title, Calm Down, seems to be particularly apt, but I just obviously has resonance for me because this is my own daughter and son-in-law, but also I love the intent of the song. They're talking about calming down within a couple, but I think it can apply in so much of our lives.
Calm down. Calm down. Mr. Man. No more pointing fingers. Calm down. Oh, calm down.
The Clementines and Calm Down, your daughter and son-in-law's band, Helena Morrissey. By the time you were CEO, as you mentioned, you'd had five of your children, including Flo, who we just heard from. You were working full-time. You've said that you and Richard had a Walton-esque fantasy about having a large family. Yeah. What was the fantasy? And tell me a little bit about the reality.
So both of us are from quite nuclear families. I have one sister. Richard has two sisters. Both of us had friends who had large, happy, chaotic families around us. So we had this shared romantic vision, which is just as well, really. But we had intended to stop at five. And clearly we did not. It's probably best to leave it at that, isn't it?
Well, except that four further children after
four,
the fifth.
Four is quite a lot more, yes.
By some considerable amount, so I feel we should...
We should explore a little bit.
A little bit more, if you wouldn't
so
mind.
Six was a happy accident, and then we had four girls and two boys. And my husband one day said, oh, it'd be great to have another son. So we gambled on that, and we did have a boy. So I think that satisfactorily explains seven, or at least logically explains seven. Then I became pregnant accidentally. Obviously, a slightly chaotic theme is running through this. And I had a miscarriage, and I was 40, I think. And I decided I had to have another baby. And I understand that's quite common, and it doesn't mean it's an excuse. And so we had our eighth child. And then nine, this is ultra embarrassing now, but she was just meant to be. She snuck her way through all the defences. And we had some interesting conversations about when I announced that I was expecting another one to Richard, because he was like, in fact, that day he said, well, no more babies. And I knew I was pregnant, and I was thinking, oh, that's awkward. I'm going to have to. Anyway, I wouldn't have it any other way. She's a wonderful, large, slightly larger than life character. And as I say, smashed her way through all the defences.
And obviously, you know, you had this kind of good night, John Boy, good night, Mama, good night, Papa fantasy.
Yeah.
Tell me about the reality. Tell me about that happy chaos.
So, well, it has been chaotic, and mostly it's been happy, and we love it when we all gather together, and it's a bit more like a banquet than just a meal. But you know, by the time we count the two grandchildren in now, and you know, three eldest have got partners, so that means I've actually going to have to quickly count that up. So we're 16 of us. So yeah, that is quite a full table, but we wouldn't have it any other way. And I've always prioritized as well getting home for family meal times, because that's been a very important part of our family life. And people sometimes said to me, well, how can you do that when you've obviously got long hours? Mm. But it's important to know what's important in your own life, I think.
Time for some more music. What's next?
So we're now on to another song from Benjamin Clementine called Condolence. And in it, he talks about giving condolence to fear and to insecurity. And when I first heard this, I thought, wow, this is almost how I feel now. That there is a moment when you're on top of all of that. And I'm not saying I never suffer from it, but my main focus in life is on positive things. And this song just seems to me to capture it sounds almost an angry way, but it's a really defiant way. And I want to give my condolence to fear and insecurity.
I no wonder why the road's
so long, 'cause I had done it all.
Part of Condolence, performed by your son-in-law, Dame Helena Morrissey, the Mercury Prize-winning Benjamin Clementine. So, of course, you are hugely successful professionally. I wonder how your personal notions of what success means have changed over the years.
Oh, I think it's very much about doing more than, you know, a job. You know, I am proud as, yeah, I'm going to use that word. I am proud of what the 30% Club's achieved, because I think it has made a difference, and it has changed the not just the conversation, but it's changed actions. But success, obviously, if you have a family, is very much about seeing them happy and healthy and thriving as well. But Richard, I mean, he has, you know, done such a huge amount in terms of bringing up 9 happy people and devoting himself to that. And if something like that is not important, I mean, it obviously is important, and everyone would say it's important. So why do we not consider that when we're assessing people's value? I do feel we've got to be more honest about the fact that success has many, many facets, and real success is much more than a big job title.
And how long do you expect to be able to maintain that drive that was first evident when you were a brownie back in the day?
Well, one of the wonderful things about life today is people don't seem to properly retire. I'm already, I suppose, doing what's called a portfolio career, and I'm staying very much involved in work on diversity as well. And I can't really see, I mean, it'd be wonderful if it didn't need doing anymore, wouldn't it? But I can't really see myself ever completely retiring, at least as long as I have my health.
Well, you'll be retiring to the island shortly. But before that, we have one more track to hear. It's your last disc today. What's it going to be, Dame Helena Morrissey?
So this is Kanye West's God Is. And I really admire what Kanye West has done, talking about his religious conversion. I think he's obviously a very controversial figure in some terms of some of his views. But this is what diverse thinking is. I'm a religious person, and, you know, this song is played in our house most nights. We have a little tiny little chapel in our house, and our children sung this at our carol service at Christmas too.
Everything that I've read, praise the Lord. Worship Christ with the best of your portions. I know I won't forget all he's done. He's the strength in this race that I run.
Kanye West and God Is, sampling James Cleveland and the Southern California Community Choir. So it's time to cast you away on your desert island, Dame Helena Morrissey. What do you think the first thing that you'll do when you get there is?
I think I have some reflection. I mean, obviously, I'm going to have a lot of time to reflect, aren't I? Tons of time. That would be quite a luxury at first. I'm sure I would get bored of my own company at a certain point, but reflection.
Well, we'll give you the books for company, luckily. The Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and a book of your choice. What would you like?
I think I'll need some laughter and humour while I'm on the island by myself. So I'm actually, assuming I can't take the whole sort of compendium, chosen P.G. Woodhouse's Much Obliged, Jeeves. It would make me laugh, which would be important.
I can also give you a luxury item to make island life more enjoyable. What would you like?
I'm going for a grand piano, because I would definitely not have any excuses for not learning the piano again, would I?
And finally, if you had to save just one of your 8 discs, which would it be?
It's going to be my first one, George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, because of the image it conjures up in my mind of my entire family singing on a very, very happy day.
Dame Helena Morrissey, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
I'm sure Helena will very quickly fine-tune her skills as a pianist on the island, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. There are many castaways from the worlds of business and finance in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue, including Sir Mervyn King, former Governor of the Bank of England, Nicola Horlick, Dame Minouche Shafiq, and Mariana Mazzucato. You can find all of those editions on BBC Sounds and, of course, a whole host of programmes from musicians to comedians, scientists to novelists to keep you going in these most difficult times. Next week, I'm delighted to say my guest will be the actor and star of the US series Succession, Brian Cox. Do join us then.
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
From the one village behind the mountain.
Imagine you're living a very different life on the other side of the world.
You feel I cannot do anything.
You live silently in the shadows.
Just stay home, bring children, make food.
And then someone takes your child, disappears into the night with your little girl, and you can't stay silent any longer. And you'll do whatever it takes. Travel thousands of miles across the globe to find your missing daughter.
This is my child. I look after this child like tiger. Just go everywhere.
Join me, Sue Mitchell, for this gripping new BBC Radio 4 podcast series. Subscribe to Girl Taken on BBC Sounds.